I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Alexander Maksik joins me again. The acclaimed writer has a new book out, Shelter in Place, and it is getting good notices, all lauding the author's deft writing and his remarkable portrayal of various themes, which we'll touch upon in the course of our conversation now. The book begins in the early 1990s Pacific Northwest, where Joe March, a 21-year-old working-class kid from Seattle, sees his life implode from within and without. He is battling symptoms of mental illness, namely bipolar disorder, and his mother kills a man and is imprisoned. I'll get Mr. Maksik to tell us about the characters in the book, Tess Wolfe, the woman Joe falls in love with, and these timely themes of finding a place in the world, love, devotion, mental illness, and modern life. Alexander Maksik is the author of You Deserve Nothing and A Marker to Measure Drift, which he was on this program with in 2013. That book was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the William Saroyan International Prize and Le Prix de Meilleur Livre Étranger. The website for more is at alexandermaksik.com. This book is published by Europa Editions. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program in New York City today, Alexander Maksik. Mr. Maksik, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Not bad.
So, I'm talking to you from Vancouver, and you know this part of the world well, having grown up in Idaho.
Yep.
You were born, I guess, in Los Angeles, so you know the West Coast well, but particularly the Pacific Northwest. And a lot of reviewers are talking about how evocatively you write of this place. Was it always a natural for you to come back to a place that you know so well?
Well, I went to college in Washington State and had ever since graduating thought about writing a story set in the Pacific Northwest and specifically in a town similar to Walla Walla, where there's a maximum security prison and a liberal arts college, and I wanted to write about the sort of contrast between those two separate worlds, and that was what drew me back to that landscape, at least originally. And then later, I began writing, I thought more and more about the time I spent there, and particularly on the coast. And so I sort of took Walla Walla and planted it on the coast to suit my purposes.
It's a part of the world that if we live here, a lot of us can take for granted. I guess now that you're on the East Coast, is that something that you realize about those of us on, people living in Oregon, say, living in Washington State?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I just finished, or nearly finished, a book tour and spent some time in Portland and Seattle, and it's been a while, I think probably since my last novel, that I'd been there and was reminded of just how much I miss that space and that air and all of those trees, and even in the city. I mean, I go back to Idaho frequently, but mm-hmm. not as frequently do I go back to Washington State and Canada and that whole area. So I do miss it, and I'm in New York right now, and I just came home to talk to you, and I'm a little tired of the congestion and of all these people, and I do miss it, and I realize how much I took it for granted when I was living there.
And I mean, and not to knock New York, because New York has got some great bookstores, but I mean, Seattle and Portland, I mean, and throughout Washington State and Oregon, having gone up and down the coast as I have. I love taking the train from here in Vancouver down.
Yeah,
there's a great book culture, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think it's funny. I was in a great bookstore in Oregon called Mother Foucault's, which I didn't know about,
mm-hmm.
And was asked to do an event there. And I walked in, and it felt so much like a bookstore that I used to go to in Paris. And I guess in a certain way, it reminds me a little bit of Shakespeare and Company. And there are fewer and fewer bookstores like that in New York. And really, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I mean, there are wonderful independents here that sell new books, but this is a used bookstore, and more primarily a used bookstore, and I love that, and I realize just how much I miss those sort of cozy, warm shops full of readers and and one of the sort of primary interests is reading and not kind of establishing a brand.
And as you said, you go back to Idaho regularly. That great bookstore in Ketchum, that's still there?
Yeah, Iconoclast Books. Mm. Yeah, it's a wonderful place.
Yeah. So your book starts with Joseph March, Joe March, narrating the story. Where do we find him as the book starts in his life?
Well, he's in his early 40s, and he's alone in a house that he built with his partner, and a woman who has left him. And so he's he's alone, looking out on a clearing where it was once to be a sort of kind of bucolic paradise, and then it's become a place of great unhappiness and reflection. And he's trying to work out exactly what's happened to him and how he came to be in this place in his life. I guess as so many people do in their early or mid 40s.
Yeah, one reviewer mentioned that you look at the rage of youth and what happens to it as one approaches middle age. What do you think your book says about that process?
Well, I'm not sure. I do think that in many ways it's a novel about the sort of end of rage, or at least the end of youthful rage and youthful passion, and I hope that it poses this question: what do we do after that fades? And there was a time when I was sentimental and a little sad, really, about losing some of that fire, and now I see it differently, and I think. I hope, anyway, that Joe March, the end of the book, also does that his he finds a way into a future that doesn't kind of turn on that nostalgia that isn't always in reference to a past that was romantic and exciting, but also debilitating and finally destructive.
That's the thing about nostalgia, isn't it? We tend to think that it's everything that's, say, good or that we would want again. But in the case of Joe's life, not all of it was roses, I guess, right?
Certainly not. No. And I mean, I agree with you. That is the problem. And nostalgia can be so paralyzing. And I think it took me a long time, I think, to fully understand that to sit in the present always recalling the glory of youth is a real it's a real handicap, and I think some people are more inclined towards that attitude than others.
And getting away from that, I guess, is a struggle as one gets older, right?
But yes. I mean, that question, as my editor said to me early on, what do we do next? And I don't think that question has to be, especially when, like Joe, he has no family, really. There are no children. He's unmarried. And he finds himself alone. And I think particularly for people who are in those positions, it's very difficult to find the energy to continue forward and not kind of fall into a rut and live primarily in the past.
Well, one of the struggles that Joe has in the book is mental illness. So for him, how does it manifest itself? And when does it really start for him?
It starts, when he's just graduated from college or just about to graduate from college. He has his first depressive episode, and shortly soon after he has his first manic episode, which coincides with him meeting this woman, Tess Wolf, with whom he falls in love, and he can't really separate that ecstasy of mania from the ecstasy of falling in love. So that's really where it begins, in his early 20s.
So we'll talk about Tess in just a sec, but another woman in his life is his mother, Anne Marie. She's in prison. Right. Why?
Because she beat a man to death with a hammer. She was in Seattle and saw this man beating his wife and child, and she came to the woman's defense, and in doing so, lost her temper and hit him over and over again with his hammer, and because she didn't stop, she went to prison.
Yeah. So the family unit at that point, because there's a dad, the mom goes to prison. There's a sister as well, right? And then of course Joe.
That's right.
What happens after prison for the four of them?
Well, Joe moves to the town where the town of White Pine, where his mother is imprisoned, following in the footsteps of his father, who's there with the idea that he will in some way be able to protect her, or at least provide her some company, some solace of a family member living close by. So there's Joe and there's his father. His sister, Joe's sister, leaves and stays in London. She's in London when this happens, and she stays there and really cuts the family off, or cuts herself off from the family. And so it's really Joe and his father and then later Tess living in this town where his mother is imprisoned.
And so the relationship with Tess, I mean, you've alluded to the nature of that relationship, but just in terms of how you say that he can't separate, Joe can't, sort of what it's like to be in love with her and the mania that he's going through. I guess that struggles throughout the book, is it?
I mean, I think that he is convinced of his utter and total love for Tess. But I think what brings them together, at least what brings Joe to her in the beginning, is a combination of that first manic episode, or the ecstasy, as I said, of that first manic episode. And whatever it is that draws a person across a room, in a bar when you're in your 20s. So it's a combination of those two things.
Yeah, and so the two of them, I mean, she also develops a relationship with the mother, doesn't she?
Yes, or she tries her best. Yeah. I think Tess is sort of wild and fiercely independent and restless person, and she sees in Anne Marie a kind of heroine, particularly when she's young. She sees that in Anne Marie there's a kind of mystery and a sort of traditionally male version of violence that she admires. It's a kind of manifestation of rage that she looks to as a kind of model. Not that that she wants to be a murderer, but she likes the idea that she seems unafraid. And when you're young, I think to idolize someone, there's not much complexity there, especially at the beginning.
Yeah, because Anne Marie, because of her imprisonment, becomes sort of a folk hero to a lot of people, because she was...
She does.
Yeah. The nature of the murder that took place was because she saw a husband, or a male, I should say, bullying a female.
That's right.
She goes in to stop that, and that's what happens with her and the hammer, I guess, right?
Right, right.
A lot of your readers have been talking about the depiction of women, and it's particularly interesting this week, especially with the result of the election in your country there.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some themes that are useful to think about as one reads your book and looks at contemporary life in America.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's true. I'm still reeling a little bit from election result. I'm not sure what is there a particular question you'd like me to address?
Yeah, I guess it could, because you depict these women in the book, especially Anne Marie and Tess. They're rather remarkable characters, and each of them have strengths, in spite of whatever else is going on around them.
Right.
And I'm. As you're writing these characters? I mean, you know, I don't know if they're inspired by women that you've encountered or women that you say research, say, but I'm wondering where they come from and where that strength comes from, say.
Well, I think, I mean, to begin with, they're certainly not based on anyone in particular.
Right.
I don't know anyone like this exactly, or like either of them exactly, but I did, the idea, I guess, comes from a desire to make the women in the novel behave the way that men so often behave in novels. They are, they're violent, they are selfish, I suppose, in certain ways, but they are also, high-minded in their ideals. They are not dependent upon the validation and love of other people to drive them. And I like the idea of Joe playing a kind of princess in his tower while his errant knight really is Tess Wolfe.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of switching those, those types. So that was that was where it began. It just seemed like an interesting a way to tell a story. And I also have the fortune of being surrounded by women who are strong and independent and well informed and fierce in their intelligences. And I spent a lot of time with these people, and as a result, I think that kind of attitude trickles in. And the women I know are, I am myself angry about the way that women are treated in this country, and given the rhetoric, as you mentioned, of this election, and the way that Hillary Clinton was talked about, and the language that Donald Trump used throughout the last 18 months, I suppose it all gets into the book in some way or another. And I mean, to go even further back, I think of my own mother, who is herself a tough, independent woman who took, am I allowed to say shit? She took no shit when I remember so often her sort of standing up for herself in ways that struck me even when I was a kid as quite brave, and in situations that frightened me when I was very young didn't seem to frighten her. And I think there's no way that this book would exist without having been raised by a woman like my mother.
Yeah, and so it speaks to, I guess, your desires of how to view people, regardless of whether they're male or female. The way that you've written the book, say, is a reaction to how we perceive one another, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm always interested, and as is every writer, I think, or at least every writer I'm interested in reading. We always want to tell a story about people that are uncommon in some way or another, and these seemed like uncommon people in that they were behaving in ways that we don't expect them to behave. I like that idea.
Yeah.
And I'm drawn to those people, and forget about fiction. I'm drawn to those people in life. I'm always interested in somebody. When I go to a party and I talk to, you talk to 10 different people at that party, I'm always drawn to the person who's doing something that seems unusual, and who has an attitude that strikes me as unusual. And I'm sure. I mean, I know that, of course, I'm not unique in that. And at the time, for whatever reason, these were the kinds of people that I wanted to make. But I'm also always hesitant to say, to pretend that I've planned too much. The way that these characters are formed is in large part accidental.
Well, what about their names? As you create their names, the names of the characters in the book, was that accidental?
No, I mean, when I say accidental, I mean that, I didn't sit down with a notebook and sort of plan the book. I didn't plot the book in the way that I know that certain people do. I mean, there's, of course, intention And the more you write, the more you come to see what it is you're doing. I mean, it's no accident that, you know, Tess's last name is Wolf. I mean, that. On the other hand, I don't remember at a certain time, you know, a certain time thinking, yes, this is the right name. I don't spend too much time thinking about the names, but
yeah,
it's a tricky thing, and I'm always a little wary of pretending that it's all too well planned or really well planned at all. I just don't work that way. I know some writers really do, but I've never been able to see it that way.
Yeah, I guess we look to the writer because they've created everything that we're holding in our hands, as
right.
You know, knowing all and say, you know, having a plan here, or you know, trying to capture the reader with whatever they've written.
I look at my book. You know, I'm in the very, very early stages of writing a new novel, and it feels again. I mean, it's so completely daunting because there are so many decisions to make, and I don't know now. You know, whether I'll write in the first person or the third, and it just seems overwhelming. And every start feels false in some way. And you know, eventually it starts to take shape for me, but it really does feel, you know, accidental. And as a friend said to me just yesterday, you know, you just have to write 50 pages and be willing to throw those pages away. And I hate that idea, and yet there's also a lot of, you know, wonder and magic in it as well.
So because you've got three books now under your belt, and you've done a lot of other writing.
Yes.
As you start a new project, I guess it doesn't get easier, does it?
I think it depends on the day. Right, the last few days it has not felt easy. I mean, there's something so exciting, and because you can. This is what I've always loved about writing, well, about art. You know, is you can do anything you want, and that's a great and exciting thing. But it is also totally terrifying. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you have the privilege of deciding, you know, the way you're going to spend your days, it's the same kind of problem. I think we often respond much better to structure and restriction. And with writing, there really is no limit.
Yeah.
There certainly shouldn't be any limit. It's just, you know, outside of one's imagination.
How do you write? Do you use a computer? Do you use paper and pen, or?
Both. I take a lot of notes as I've been traveling these last few months. I've been writing, you know, using. I have a notebook that I keep away with each book, and I have pages and pages of these notes, ideas, questions, you know, little pieces of text. And then when I sit down, as I've just started to do, to actually type, I use a computer. And I go back and forth between the notebooks. I always have a notebook with me, and the computer usually stays in my apartment.
Yeah, and so do you find that you can write anywhere, or I guess you have to do the writing where your computer is, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can write in a notebook about anywhere, but I can't really write what ends up being the book. Those somehow I see a distinction between the two things.
Yeah.
I think it probably just provides me the illusion of, you know, of an ordered life by you know, writing and, you know, on a computer in one place and keeping the notebook with me. I don't know. Yeah. As you can tell, I'm not entirely sure how I do this.
do you journal or keep a diary, say?
I don't. I always regret that I don't have the discipline to do it. I've tried before, and I've always failed. I don't know. I can't bring myself to do it.
Yeah, it's always interesting about I guess writing about ourselves.
Yeah,
I think that's what makes it harder. Say,
I think you're right, and I also think that I'm too self-conscious to write badly. And I think when I'm writing journal entries, for it to be honest, it has to be pretty badly written at first. And I think I don't know, I can't bring myself to do it. I think I'm probably too stuck thinking about the quality of the sentence, and it stops me from, you know, from writing kind of mundane sentences.
As a lot of your readers have been saying, a lot of reviewers as well, about the writing in your book, Shelter in Place, they're talking about how accurately you depict mental illness. And Joe has bipolar disorder. And as I'm reading the book, I see that you're giving voice to what it's like to have that illness. Was that important for you to reflect accurately what that's like for someone like Joe?
Very, yes. But I wanted to do it, you know, in a way that didn't seem at all clinical. That felt I wanted him to be, well, a little bit childlike in a sense. I wanted him to be unchecked and a little wild and confessional. So that was the idea, and that was important to me. I wanted the reader's experience to be as close to Joe's experience as possible. Those are the more I read, the more I find that I get pleasure most of all from writing that feels in some way immersive rather than abstracted and sort of overly thought out and intellectual.
We talked a moment ago about women and how they're perceived in the culture. You know, it's 2016, and it's funny how it's not funny, but it's interesting how there isn't the right. I mean, we're not reacting to mental illness. We're not. We don't have the right reaction to say women that we ought to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess in a way, this book speaks to how perhaps we should where we should be, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. But on the other hand, you know, I didn't set out to, you know, to write a kind of treatise. I didn't want. It's not an argument in any way, really. I don't think, or at least I didn't intend for it to be. But on the other hand, I do hope that by writing about this, you know, writing from so close within a person who suffers from bipolar disorder, that, you know, that a reader, as with any experience, I would like the reader to have some sense of what it might be like to live with this version of bipolar disorder.
Yeah, because we don't know how to react to it when we encounter it, don't we?
Right. Well, I think it, you know, it depends, of course, on one's experience. I am, you know, I have some experience with bipolar disorder. I know a lot of artists, and I think almost by definition, if you know a lot of artists, you know a lot of people who suffer from some mental disorder or another. And I know a lot of their partners. And so it seems perhaps, I don't know, very, very present in my life. And I nearly said, you know, more present, but I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that, you know, mental illness is a problem that you know, a huge percentage of the population suffers from. And, you know, it is still, I think, for all of our talk of depression, profoundly stigmatized in our culture, and I think that is certainly unfortunate.
Yeah. Another theme in the book is finding a place of refuge, and I guess, is that something, because Joe is where he is now in his early 40s, that he's thinking about, or I guess it's something that we're all thinking about throughout our lives, isn't it? Finding a place where we belong.
Yeah, I think, you know, his or their brand of refuge is one of isolation. You know, their fantasy did not include, you know, a community of people. And I think in certain ways that's a mistake. That's certainly a mistake that I have made over the course of my life. You know, when whatever painful experience I've had, my instinct is often to retreat entirely, to leave the country, to go, you know, to disappear into the woods. And I think the romance of that, just like the romance of mental illness, really, or the romance of being an artist, or, you know, all of that, it's of a piece. And you know, there's really nothing lovely about mental illness. And there's nothing really all that lovely about being a writer in the way that we imagine, you know, the suffering writer when we're when we're young. And I think, you know, part of the mistake they've made is that they went off into the woods to live by themselves, and in doing so rejected, you know, community. And I think that's a dangerous and particularly American romance.
Yeah. And we talked a moment ago about your process in terms of writing and whether it gets easier as you go on. But as you work out what you work out in terms of these characters that you write about and whatever they get themselves into in terms of the story, do you change as a person with each book?
It's a great question, and I love the idea that I am changed by each book that I write. But it does occur to me that perhaps, you know, I have changed, and as a result, I am writing a different book. You know, I don't know what comes first, but I certainly felt changed for having written A Marker to Measure Drift, and I think I've changed, but it takes me 3 years, it seems, to write a novel, and if I don't change over the course of 3 years, then I'm doing something wrong.
It's growth, I guess, right? Not just getting older, right?
No, I hope not. My life changes so dramatically in the course of 3 years, and partly maybe that's because I travel a lot, and partly it's because I'm not really in a rut in terms of my profession. I mean, I'm not in a, you know, I have the fortune of not working 9 to 5 in an office. So I do feel as if I am evolving in certain ways, or at least my life makes me feel that way.
See, I guess I was wondering how you changed as a writer, because in reading reviews not only of this book but your previous ones about how affected people are by what you've written. And I just thought, well, if it's affecting his readers a certain way, I'm wondering how that affects him.
I want the process of writing to, I want it to be emotional, and I want it to matter, and I want to write what feels essential to write. I want it to be difficult in an emotional way. And when I'm writing and it feels bland, or I find that I don't care, that to me is a really, and I don't mean to be dramatic, but it is in a certain way a kind of painful experience. I hate writing, and maybe this is why I don't write in a journal. I hate writing and feeling nothing. Editing, I can feel nothing. Editing, I think it's important to feel nothing.
Yeah.
But, or to feel, you know, or to be colder anyway.
Detached,
but an early draft, I want it to feel essential in some way or another. And I too often I read fiction that just feels like it may as well have not been written at all, that the writer really is just doing it for some reason. And I can't imagine what that reason is, because, you know, surely it's not to get paid.
Excuse me. No, I interrupted you. Go ahead. Pardon me.
That's really it. That seems key to me. And every artist I have ever admired, whether it be a musician or a painter or a writer, I have that same sense from their work.
Yeah.
That there's blood there.
Yeah.
It's crucial for the writer to have made this thing that, or musician or whatever. And I think we are always looking to people who are able to do that. And then in many ways, I think that's what this book is about. The effort to translate profound feeling into something that you can, that is an object of some kind.
As a writer, do you? I guess you find that reading is a critical part of your day, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you consume television, films? Say.
I do. Yeah. I love good television. I love film. I think I'm probably far more democratic in my consumption of television and film than I am of literature, and that I think is just a kind of snobbery. I'm trying to read more more fiction that is not considered quote unquote literary. Because I want to write all kinds of books, and it's, you know, if I'm only reading the books that are sort of certified by a very small percentage of people, I think I'm doing myself a disservice. And it's not at all the way I watch TV.
I guess I was the other thing that I was wondering about you as a writer, because I don't write, and when I read books like yours, you know, I'm mesmerized and I'm amazed by what I'm reading. And so as a writer, if you're reading someone else's work and you get those same feelings, I'm wondering how that influences, say, your own work as a writer.
I try not to read books that I don't admire. You know, if I'm bored, I stop. I want to give whatever I'm reading a fair shake, but I also know pretty quickly whether or not it's the kind of thing that I'm going to be interested by. I can easily watch a bad film, but it's almost impossible for me to read a bad novel.
Yeah.
And I may be part of that as a kind of superstition. I'm afraid that it'll somehow infiltrate my my mind. In a way that I'm not going to like.
Well, this book for me, I've just started it. It's got me thinking about a lot of things beyond just what you've written, and I guess that's to your credit, because I'm reading the reviews of this book, and a lot of people are saying that sort of the same things about how it's impacted them and how it's touched their lives, or at least in those moments that they've read the book. I mean, that must be gratifying to hear reviewers say these things about your work.
I have tried, really, especially with this book, to not to read too many reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I have not kept my promise, and there have been, you know, I have read the, for lack of a better word, the major reviews.
Right.
I have stayed as far away from Goodreads and Amazon. I've learned my lesson about that, but I was in Toronto for the IFOA festival, and I was in Calgary for the festival there, and have been traveling all over the place, and you know, the response from readers who've read the book, people who seem to have liked it and had a kind of emotional reaction to it. That's very gratifying, absolutely. And when somebody, you know, writes to me and says something, it's not so much that people say nice things that affects me. It's when people say things that I think, well, that's exactly what I was hoping for.
Yeah,
that's exciting to me, because you never, you know, mm-hmm. you really never know.
Right.
You never know, and that's one of the scary things. And again, it's also one of the most exciting things, is that you sit there alone, writing, and eventually the book is published, if you're lucky, and then you hope someone will read it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, already the likelihood is not great. And when someone reads the book, when the book finds its way to some stranger, I mean, there's something miraculous about the fact that, you know, we're having this conversation right now. I think maybe if I were more successful in the traditional sense, I would be less grateful and less excited by the idea that complete strangers are, you know, reading my work. So one of the advantages of not being hugely successful in that sense is that I still am excited by those things.
Yeah, you haven't got all that money to enjoy, I guess, right?
So yeah, well, I mean, I have known and know some writers who sell a lot more books than I do, and I think, you know, after a certain point, it gets probably a little boring.
Right.
They're not, you know, an email from a grateful reader is a common thing.
Yeah.
And you know, it happens from time to time for me, but it doesn't happen perhaps with the same frequency that it does for someone, say, like John Irving.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure talking to you again, and as I said,
oh, to you as well.
And as I said as we started, I mean, I can't wait to finish this book.
Thank you. Well, I hope you enjoy it, and let me know when you finish.
Yeah, I have enjoyed it already. Congratulations and continued good luck with it. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The website is at alexandermaksik.com. The book is called Shelter in Place. It is published by Europa Editions. Its author, Alexander Maksik, joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.